Welcome to Akhotra Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Akhotra AI. Welcome back. Today, we're diving deep into a novel that often tops the greatest ever lists, George Eliot's Middlemarch, a study of provincial life.
It's a giant, definitely. And our goal today is to kind of unpack its sheer scale, but also its incredible psychological depth.
Absolutely. A masterpiece of Victorian realism.
That's right. Published around 1871, 1872. But crucially, the story itself is set earlier. Think 1829 to 1832.
Right before the First Reform Act. Why that specific period, just before things really started changing nationally?
Well, that's Eliot being clever, isn't it? It sets up this tension. You've got this looming national change, the Reform Act promising, you know, massive shifts in power, voting rights.
Huge stuff.
Exactly. But she places the story right before it hits. In this provincial town, Middlemarch, where everything feels slow, almost stuck. Gossip, local politics, old money.
So it highlights the clash between the potential for change and the inertia of everyday life.
Precisely. It really sets the stage for the personal tragedies, the theme of limited opportunities, especially for the idealists in the story.
And the author herself, George Eliot, or Marianne Evans, rather, she wasn't just a novelist, was she? She was a serious intellectual.
Oh, absolutely. A powerhouse.
Yeah.
Deeply involved in philosophy, translating German thinkers like Feuerbach. Plus, she was really engaged with the science at the time.
So the male pseudonym wasn't just about getting published.
Well, it was certainly pragmatic for a woman writer then, yes, but it also reflected her approach, I think, this ability to combine really rigorous, almost scientific analysis of society and character with this deep, deep emotional insight. It's like she had a philosopher's brain and a poet's heart working together.
Okay, so let's get into the core of it. The subtitle, A Study, sounds almost clinical. What's the central mission here?
It really is a study. Eliot is putting human nature under a microscope within this specific social environment. And the big question she keeps asking is, well, what happens when people with really noble ideas, big dreams, idealism,
like wanting to change the world?
Exactly. What happens when that slams into the wall of ordinary, messy provincial life? The compromises, the limitations, the disappointments.
And how does she structure that exploration?
Through this incredible central metaphor. The web of causation. It's fundamental to understanding Middlemarch.
The web. Explain that a bit more.
Eliot sees society as this incredibly complex, interwoven, well, web. No character acts in isolation. Every single choice, even seemingly small ones, who you marry, how you vote on a local issue, a casual remark.
It all connects.
It all ripples outwards, often in ways the characters themselves don't even see. It affects families, reputations, finances, the whole community fabric. It's all interconnected.
So is the message that idealism just gets inevitably tangled and crushed?
Not necessarily crushed, but definitely complicated. It's often about the choices the idealists make, their own blind spots, how they try or fail to navigate this web.
And we see this mainly through two key characters.
Yes, two parallel stories, really. You have Dorothea Brooke, who's driven by this almost spiritual ambition, and then Tertius Lydgate, the ambitious scientific doctor. Both start with such high hopes.
Let's start with Dorothea. She's quite something, full of passion, but also frustration.
Oh, intensely so. She has this extraordinary moral fervor, as Eliot puts it, a real desire to do something meaningful, something great for humanity. But she's trapped by the expectations of her time, her gender, her class.
Eliot's phrase for her is devastatingly accurate, isn't it? Spiritual grandeur ill-matched with the meanness of opportunity.
Perfectly put. She has the soul of a saint or a reformer, but society basically just expects her to marry well and manage a household.
Which leads directly to her first major and quite disastrous choice, marrying Edward Casaubon.
Ah, Casaubon. The middle-aged, dried-up scholar. Dorothea makes this classic mistake of the young idealist. She projects all her hopes onto him. She sees his lifelong, failing project, the key to all mythologies, and imagines him as this profound genius she can serve.
She falls in love with the idea of him, not the man himself.
Exactly. She idealizes the scholarship, thinking it's deep wisdom, when really it's just pedantry, dusty, sterile, and ultimately second rate.
And the honeymoon in Rome is where this illusion just shatters, right? It's quite painful to read.
It's brutal. Instead of finding intellectual partnership, she finds, his deep insecurity, his jealousy, his utter smallness of mind. She sees this scholarly inadequacy firsthand and realizes he can't connect with her, or perhaps anyone, on a genuine human level.
And right into that emotional vacuum steps Will Ladislaw.
The complete opposite of Casaubon, isn't he? Casaubon's younger cousin, charming, artistic, passionate, politically aware, he represents everything vibrant and alive that Casaubon lacks.
So Casaubon eventually dies, but he gets one last act of spite with that codicil in his will.
Oh, the codicil. It's pure malice. He forbids Dorothea from marrying Ladislaw, stipulating she'll lose her inheritance if she does. It's his way of controlling her even from the grave, fueled by his jealousy.
But this actually becomes her moment of liberation, in a way.
It forces her hand, yes. It makes her confront what truly matters. Her journey is about moving from that abstract, grand idealism. You know, wanting to design cottages for the poor without really understanding their lives towards something much more grounded.
Real human connection.
Exactly. Choosing love, choosing authenticity with will, even if it means giving up wealth and social standing. It's about finding value in genuine relationships, not just grand theories. A hard-won wisdom.
Okay, let's switch tracks to Tertius Lydgate. He arrives in Middlemarch with so much promise.
He really does. He's the modern man, the scientist, ambitious, bringing new ideas about medicine, research. He wants to discover the fundamental tissue of life. He's part of this rising professional class.
He seems like he should succeed where Dorothea, constrained by her gender, couldn't.
He has the knowledge, the drive, the position, but he has his own fatal flaw. Despite all his scientific brilliance, Eliot tells us he has this massive blind spot regarding women and social relationships.
He's rational about medicine, but not about people, especially women.
Precisely. He holds these very conventional, almost superficial views about what a wife should be. Pretty, accomplished, an ornament to his life, someone who won't interfere with his work.
Like a decorative object. And that leads him straight to Rosamund Vincy.
Osmond. She's the town beauty, perfectly poised, plays the piano beautifully, but underneath, utterly self-absorbed. Eliot portrays her brilliantly, this core of unyielding selfishness and vanity.
Her only real goal is social status and elegance, right?
That's it. She wants the lifestyle she thinks she deserves, the fine things, the social admiration. And Lydgate, in his blindness, just sees the beautiful surface. He completely misreads her.
And this marriage becomes the anchor that drags him down. How does she do it? It's not overt conflict, is it?
No. That's what's so insidious. It's her passive resistance, her quiet insistence on expensive furniture, clothes, maintaining appearances, her refusal to economize, her subtle manipulation.
It just drains him financially.
Cripplingly so. He gets deeper and deeper into debt. And this financial pressure forces him into compromises he would never have imagined making.
Which connects him to Bulstrode, the town banker with a dark past.
Exactly. Bulstrode needs Lydgate's silence, or at least his complicity, regarding a past scandal involving blackmail. Lydgate gets entangled, accepting a loan from Bulstrode, which looks terrible later on. His professional integrity, the thing he valued most, gets compromised.
So the brilliant researcher who wanted to change medicine ends up where?
Defeated, essentially. He's forced to give up his research, his reform ambitions. He leaves Middlemarch, moves to London, and becomes a fashionable doctor treating wealthy patients with gout. Successful on the surface.
But intellectually dead inside.
Completely. A total loss of his original potential. It's a really powerful warning about how personal flaws and bad choices, especially in relationships, can just derail everything.
It's quite bleak. But Eliot doesn't leave it there, does she? There are other threads in this web.
No. Thankfully, there's a crucial counterpoint, a more hopeful storyline, with Fred Vincy and Mary Garth.
Fred is Rosamund's brother, starts off pretty useless.
Very much so. Irresponsible, gambler, always in debt. But his love for Mary Garth, who is arguably the novel's moral compass, changes him.
Tell us about Mary.
Mary is plain, practical, fiercely honest, completely unpretentious. She sees Fred's flaws, but also his potential for goodness. Their relationship isn't about grand passion or ideals. It's built on mutual respect, honesty, and quite realistic expectations.
And Mary's own integrity is rock solid, like with the Peter Featherstone will incident.
Oh, absolutely central. Yeah. Featherstone is this wealthy old relative. On his deathbed, he tries to get Mary to destroy one of his wills, which would benefit Fred. But she refuses.
Even though it would secure Fred's future.
Even then. She won't compromise her conscience, won't be party to something potentially dishonest. It's a quiet act, but it speaks volumes about her character, especially when you contrast it with the moral compromises swirling around Bulstrode and Lydgate.
And these threads all come together when the Bulstrode scandal finally erupts involving Lydgate.
Yes. The web tightens dramatically. Bulstrode's past associate, Raffles, shows up, threatens blackmail. Raffles gets sick while staying at Bulstrode's. Lydgate treats him. And Raffles dies.
And the town jumps to conclusions.
Instantly. The rumor mill goes into overdrive. Did Lydgate somehow help Raffles die to protect Bulstrode, maybe for money? Mm. It doesn't matter that it's not true. The suspicion alone is enough.
Gossip and assumption just destroy Lydgate's reputation.
Completely. The very community he came to serve turns against him, fueled by suspicion and Bulstrode's enemies. He's ostracized.
And this is where Dorothea steps back in a really significant way.
It's her defining moment, I think.
Yeah.
Everyone else condemns Lydgate, believes the worst. But Dorothea, despite her own pain and disillusionment, sees his fundamental decency. She decides to publicly stand by him.
She goes to see him, offer support when no one else will.
Yes. It's this act of pure, brave empathy. It shows how far she's come. Her idealism isn't about abstract schemes anymore. It's about recognizing and responding to the suffering of another human being right there in front of her, defying the crowd. It's concrete moral action.
So, pulling back, what are the big themes Elliot is really digging into with this intricate study? Marriage and gender seem crucial.
Hugely. It's a powerful critique of Victorian limitations. Look at Dorothea, this immense potential, this ardor. But society essentially says, get married, that's your role. She's the foundress of nothing, not because she lacked ability, but because the opportunities just weren't there for women.
And the failed marriages Dorothea Casaubon, Lydgate Rosmond, seem to be built on illusions.
Exactly. Idealism versus pedantry, scientific ambition versus pure vanity. They fail because they aren't based on mutual understanding or respect. Contrast that with Fred and Mary. Their marriage works because it is built on knowing each other, flaws and all, and choosing to build a life together realistically.
Another huge theme seems to be this battle between egoism and empathy.
Oh, central. So many characters are trapped in their own perspective. Casaubon's jealous ego, Rosamond's vanity. They literally can't see the world from anyone else's point of view.
And Elliot has that amazing metaphor for this, the pier glass.
Yes, the pier glass metaphor. It's brilliant. She compares our egoism to standing before a mirror with scratches on it. We arrange the reflections of the world, the candles, the room, so they seem to revolve around those scratches around us. We mistake our own limited, flawed perspective for the whole picture.
We see everything centered on ourselves.
We do. We struggle to truly imagine the inner life of others, to see the world as they see it. Elliot is constantly pushing us, the readers, to try and overcome that egoism.
And the narrator helps us do that, the famous omniscient narrator.
Absolutely. The narrator isn't just telling the story. They're guiding us, commenting, offering insights, pushing us towards sympathy. Even for difficult characters like Casaubon, the narrator shows us his loneliness, his fear of failure.
So the narrator acts like a kind of moral guide.
A moral philosopher, almost. Encouraging us to think critically about why people act the way they do, about social pressures, about our own judgments. It trains us in empathy.
So after all this complexity, all these failures and compromises, what's the final message? Does Elliot offer any hope?
I think she offers a very profound, quiet kind of hope. It's not about achieving grand ambitions necessarily. It's about the value found in ordinary, often unnoticed, lives lived with integrity.
Which brings us to those famous, incredible closing lines.
Yes, they resonate so powerfully. Let me see if I recall them correctly. For the growing good of the world is partly dependent on unhistoric acts, and that things are not so ill with you and me as they might have been is half owing to the number who live faithfully a hidden life and rest in unvisited tombs.
Unhistoric acts. It suggests that real significance isn't always in the big headlines, the public achievements.
Exactly. It's in the daily choices, the small kindnesses, the integrity we maintain in our private lives, the quality of our relationships. That's where the growing good of the world comes from, Elliot suggests. Maybe true greatness lies in living that hidden life faithfully. Middlemarch really stays with you. It teaches that maybe the biggest dramas, the most important choices, happen quietly inside us, choosing empathy over ego. And finding wisdom means learning to accept life's limits with a measure of grace.
It makes you think, doesn't it, about those unhistoric acts, what small choices, what hidden moments of integrity or failure to connect are shaping your own little corner of the world today. Something to definitely mull over. This conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.